Welcome. This is a recording of a telecall that was done on October 3rd to talk about tarot and to talk about my deck, Tarot Waiting to Happen. This recording was done live and has been left in its entirety, so please excuse any bumps and false starts along the way. If you do not have my deck, and really please consider ordering it, but if you don't have it, you certainly can see all the images on my website at thehermitslamp.com/TWTH. That's Tarot Waiting to Happen. And you can also, while you're there, download the PDF that I reference, which is the workbook for the spread that we do. Please do get in touch and let me know what you think and how it works for you. And if you are working with the spread, please feel free to share it with people, but please do give me credit for inventing it. Thanks a lot. Enjoy.
In tonight's workshop, or tonight's call, what we're going to do is three separate things. First thing that we're going to do is we're going to talk about the creativity and the idea behind why I made this deck and sort of what I think it has to say to people and working with tarot in general. And then we're going to go through and talk a little bit about each of the major arcana and how this notion of what was going on before the card that we're accustomed to seeing, you know, how that question and in general that approach can add to and inform anybody's understanding of whatever deck that they're working with. And then after we go through that, I think that'll be the first hour. After that, we're going to talk about this tarot spread that I've created to work to undo and make clear the sort of hidden agendas that we all carry with us that that motivate us and direct us, even though we like to think that we have grown and evolved and done a lot of great work and that they're just gone and never going to come back. So it's a spread for kind of treating a future event that we want to make happen as if we were looking backwards at it in some ways, kind of like the deck does, to step backwards from the event we're accustomed to seeing, to look at what happened to bring us to that place. And then after that, there's going to be some time for questions and conversation and whatever questions anybody might have about the deck itself, about tarot, about any of the stuff that we've talked about tonight. So we'll have plenty of time for questions at the end too. But as I said, if you do have questions that are part of what's going on, and certainly if I'm saying something and it's not clear to you, then really please do, jump into that conversation and ask me, because partly everyone else might have those questions, or people listening to this recording in the future might have those questions. And I certainly want to make sure that what I think I'm saying, and no matter how clear I think I'm being about stuff, that everybody really is sort of getting the gist of it. So let me start by saying I didn't intend to make this deck. I was talking before the call with someone, and we were discussing the fact that I actually started another deck, did a few cards, drew about the first dozen cards, had some plans for them, painted several of the cards, and then my life got really busy with, stuff. I have kids and a family and, work that keeps me busy, and I basically just found it very hard to find up the time to set up my paints and sit down and work for hours uninterrupted. And so I basically put that project on hold. And I was working on some cards for a tarot show that we have here. Usually every year I have a tarot-themed art show at my store. And I was just doing some drawings for that. And this is my secret confession. It was actually the day of the show, and I had been so busy I had not gotten around to creating my cards yet. And I had some ideas and some sketches and whatever. But then as I was sitting down to draw them, and I drew all these things on my iPad with a pressure-sensitive stylus and an application called Paper, and I sat down and I started drawing, and I was just really frustrated with what was going on, and I was very, feeling compressed. And I just started to doodle and draw backwards. So I'm like, it'd be really funny. It'd be really funny to see the emperor hanging out in his boxer shorts before he goes and sits on the throne. And then I started to think about it more, and a piece of writing that I had done, about a year ago, about the fool and why the fool left his home. Why did he actually get up and leave the comfort to go wander the country? And in that article, the story went that he was sitting by the fire, and a spark drifted out and landed on his dog, which made his dog yell and freak out. And so despite the fact that he was very comfortable in his lazy boy recliner, he decided it was time to get out and go for a walk. And once he was out walking the dog, he realized how dissatisfied he was with his life and how he really didn't want to go back to work the next day. And so he didn't. He went on this journey and abandoned everything. So, you know, these ideas started to swirl around in my mind. And what sort of started out as a little joke kind of became this sort of much richer set of ideas and imagery for me. And so as I started to work on the cards, I realized that, you know, some of them emerged very fully formed. You know, the fool card, which is, or Lamat, was the first card that I drew, and it stayed in its original iteration. You know, and many of the later cards that I drew also stayed in their original form. But a lot of the cards, as I was working on them, changed and shifted. And some of the things that were very interesting to me about the process was, in some ways, much like when people are learning tarot, there's a card or two that they get stuck with. You know, they're like, I just don't get this Hierophant guy. What is he all about? Why is he there? What does he mean? You know, and everybody has their own card when it comes to that, I think. You know, for me, it was some of the court cards, you know, and a couple of the number cards were very difficult for me to interpret when I was first going. You know, everybody has these cards. And when it comes to me and working on this deck, there were several cards that took forever. And, you know, those cards were the High Priestess. Took me an incredibly long time to decide upon. The Justice card was one of the last cards that I did. The Tower card, although I drew it and was very satisfied with it for a very long time, once I saw all of the deck together collectively, I really disliked it. So I went back and rechanged it because it didn't convey enough to me. So, you know, for me, part of the issue too with creating these cards was when I was painting things, I work with gouache, which is a very opaque kind of watercolor almost. And it's a very technically demanding form because the paint itself never actually sets. So it's not that, you know, like acrylic or to some extent even oil paints where you can just slap something on top and nothing will kind of change too much underneath. With this paints, if you put any water on it at all, it becomes liquid again. So you can completely rework any area that you're working on. But mostly what happens if you rework something too much, it becomes muddied. It just blends in. And even worse, if you drop a droplet of water on there, then it can actually erase or move chunks of your paint. So it's a very technical kind of way of working. And I'd been wanting to do and had for a while been working to do stuff that was much more free and easy, things that didn't require as much discipline of technique and structure. And so when I was making the work, I wanted them to be very flowing and easy, and I wanted them to be very graphical and gestural so that there was movement and flow to what was going on with them. But I also wanted to make them so that they weren't really too identifiable as specific people. I didn't, you know, although any of the cards, you can tell, you know, to some extent what gender they're meant to be, the reality is that I wanted the characters to be, to some extent, largely neutral. Because I don't think that any particular character or gender is necessary for any of the cards. You know, the fool doesn't need to be male. The fool doesn't need to be female. And especially the fool in many ways is actually very open to interpretation as it's often a very androgynous kind of character. So I drew the characters when I was making the deck. I wanted them to be kind of open to interpretation, but but to kind of work to try and give them some kind of emotion or expression as part of them. And the other aspect of the card is I certainly wanted everything to be humorous in one way or another. And, you know, I mean, not every card has a joke in it as such, but on the other hand, I didn't want them to be weighty and serious and, you know, ponderous. You know, the other stuff that I was working on was very esoterically complex Gnostic iconography that lacked a playfulness, even though it was very dynamic. And so I wanted something that was actually really fun and free and very easy for people to access. That said, my background certainly draws a lot on the study of Kabbalah and astrology and alchemy and all of these kinds of ideas. So I wanted to include symbols and symbolism that had a lot to do with what was going on, so that there would be a relationship between the traditional meanings and things like the Tough deck or the Hermetic deck or even the Rider-Waite deck and other decks along those lines, you know, that those symbolisms that were there would be carried out into this in some capacity in a way that would allow people to interpret the symbols better. In part, also, you know, I'll answer the question of why did I not include a little white book with this deck? You know, part of the issue for me when it comes to creating this deck is I see this deck as a question that is answered by a series of questions that is meant to challenge the person looking at the cards to think and disrupt their assumptions about what the cards might mean in general. Everybody has their specific starting points. And, you know, as I mentioned, I started off working with the Toth deck. It was the tarot deck of choice for me for, you know, the better part of 20 years. And I will often default to that. But defaulting to that deck in some ways also limits me, because decks that stray from that or come from other traditions are often jarring and uncomfortable for me. And it can be easy to disrupt or to dismiss those decks and say, oh, well, you know, they don't really fit, or they're just so different that it doesn't really matter. And I wanted to, you know, deliberately kind of challenge people to look at decks and go, well, what is going on here? Why is that there? And what does that have to say? And how does this relate to the cards that I'm accustomed to working with? And so working with this deck, I see it less as a series of statements and sort of overt artistic sort of dialogue about it, as I do is sort of a series of visual questions and visual probing to kind of tickle people's imagination and encourage them to expand beyond what they have thought and to look around the corner, or to stand on their head and look at the cards, or, you know, to view it from a different perspective, in the hopes of really helping people get to what is deeper and core to the cards. So, and the other thing is that although my background for most of my career as a tarot person has been in the esoteric and toss directions, my current deck of choice is the Noble Marseille deck. So it's a reprint of the 1650 Marseille variation. And so all of these cards reference that specific set of imagery as well, hence the French titles. You know, the details like leaving the number off the Fool, you know, all of these kinds of things. So the first cool card that I want to talk about is the Fool. And one of the things that is very central to my notion of the Fool card is that before he was the Fool, he was someone who had a specific life and was very concrete and structured. And so, you know, the Fool, you know, if we look at it as the whole tarot as a circle, the Fool evolves from the World card, which is a card of order and structure. If we look at the normal depictions of it, we have usually the four animals in the four corners. We have a wreath of some kind. We have, you know, this very sort of organized and geometric structure. And the card that comes after that, if we loop back around on ourselves, is the Fool card, which is a card of complete lack of structure and dissolution, you know, of finding ourselves in the present, about living in the now and all of these kinds of things. And so the question to some extent is, how does the fool go from being in the world card and choosing, having chosen or being raised to this structure, to becoming this sort of wandering searcher? And if we look at the Marseille deck, you know, the dog that we're accustomed to seeing, you know, in the Rider-Waite-Smith as a lovely little companion is actually a monstrous little beast, you know, attacking this person, right? And even in other decks, we see similar monsters or similar ideas, right? And so here we have this sort of notion of the dog in this card is very tranquil, you know, is very serene. Everything is structured and ordered, and yet chaos looms, you know? And I know some people there have had dogs, but if you've had a dog and that dog starts to freak out about something, it is an immensely transformative experience. You know, we had a bull mastiff for a long time, and that is almost 120 pounds of drooly love. And, you know, when she hurt her foot and was freaking out about it, it was intense to try and deal with that, because that's a great big dog that is intent on, you know, getting outside and running and trying to figure out what's going on with itself. So we have this sort of idea of the dog, although controlled, is capable of breaking that control under some ideas. Beyond that, we have this sort of little beehive hanging at the top here. And if we look at the symbolism of the bee, it's often a symbol of royalty. It's often a symbol of rulers. If we look at the Thoth cards of the Emperor, it is embroidered all over the Emperor's throne. And if we look throughout that deck, we will see it in various places to represent power, wisdom, achievement, and attainment. And yet the bee itself is often a problematic animal as well, as anyone who's been stung by one will know. You know, you get stung by that bee and you're not thinking, goodness, I better go sit and meditate and, you know, connect with my higher self. You're thinking, oh my God, that hurt. I got to get away from here. I've got to, you know, slap that thing and get it out of me. I've got to, you know, there's a little dance almost that comes uncontrollably from being stung by an insect like that. And so the notion, though, that this entity that feeds us, right? You know, if we even look at the state of the world now with the bees, the bees are responsible for so much of the food that we eat and for sustaining so much of the even the animal life indirectly through the continued propagation of plants, that we are fed by these animals. And there's this sort of notion that the bee is a symbol of the thing that feeds this work of pursuing enlightenment and pursuing understanding. And so we have this sort of notion that the initial trigger, even in that discomfort, even in that unpleasant thing that moves people from towards being the fool and then from the fool towards being more established cards and back towards order again, it is motivated by spirit. It is motivated by this thing that pushes us towards higher levels of consciousness and higher energies. So the next card that we have is the Magician. And, you know, when we look at the Magician, especially in the Marseille deck, we're looking at a street performer. You know, we're looking at the juggler. We're looking at the, you know, to a certain extent, maybe even the huckster, you know. And so here, you know, initially in the Fool, we have the Fool who is wandering off, not worrying about anything. When we get to the Magician, or we get to the juggler, we get this character who is trying to make his way in the world. Everything is not just flowing and easy. He's not, you know, stepping off the cliff, gazing at the sun and the butterflies and ready for whatever may happen. Here we have someone who is actually trying to get ahead in the world. He still carries everything with him, like the Fool does in his little over-his-shoulder bag, but here everything contains a sense of more structure. And once we get to the Magician, there's also this notion of dependence between us and other people. You know, the Magician can't really make any money doing his show by himself. He needs an audience. He needs engagement with the world, and he needs this kind of structure. At the same time, the Magician, whether we think of them as you know, in a more modern concept as like ceremonial magicians or shamans or, you know, any of these kinds of ideas, or whether we're thinking of them in terms of the performer, they're always outsiders, right? And so here we have this character who is certainly an outsider. They are a vagabond of some sort, right? And they are hitchhiking their way from, you know, from coast to coast, from place to place, looking for where they're going to go and what's next for them. And we also sort of see this idea that other people are still necessary to them. It is the interaction between them and other people. You know, they're waiting for that car to come and help them get there. They know that they are interdependent with other people, even though they themselves are aware of their own completeness and wholeness. So, again, this is a very contrasted to the fool kind of energy, where the fool doesn't really conceive of themselves as needing anybody else because they don't really conceive of themselves. They just float from experience to experience. And so if they are caught up waiting for other people, you know, they start to lose their foolishness and they would just drift off. So anything that requires them paying too much attention to others just doesn't happen. Whereas with the magician, there is this sort of level of calculation and consciousness to everything that's going on. The next card that I'm going to talk about here is the High Priestess. For me, the High Priestess speaks of intuitive connection, of connecting with this divine power in a way that is silent and receptive. Not passive, because they're very, very active in what they do, and yet they're not performing ceremonies. They're not orating to the public. They are channeling and receiving in a way that is quite different from what the, say the counterpart of this card, the Hierophant or the Pope does, right? And so this is one of the cards that I really struggled with, because the High Priestess or the Papess, to me, is already so silent. She is so withdrawn from the world that I found it very hard to sort of conceive of what it was that she would be doing, you know, or what was it that they did before they were there, you know, enshrined on this throne, dispensing their channeled wisdom. And, you know, I was drawing all these faces, and there's, you know, I have like 30 different drawings for this card at least, of different ways I thought about drawing it, different kind of positions and attitudes and ornaments and all of these kinds of things. And then what I started to realize was that the Papess or the High Priestess lives solely in connection with the divine, solely in connection with that source. And so when they are withdrawn from public, when they are not sitting on the throne and acting in some sort of religious capacity or spiritual capacity, they are in direct communion with that source. And that is essentially what they are about. And so in that sense, I realized that, number one, we don't get to see their face, because when they look directly upon the source, we can't even begin to comprehend that. Or at least most people can. I'm not denying that people in this call or people listening to this recording might be enlightened beings beyond measure. But in general, people don't really get to look upon the face of God in any concrete way. When it comes to, you know, this card, I also realized that what they were doing was they were caught in prayer or meditation, that their previous moment was one of even deeper silence and connection than the channeling silence, which we usually see them doing. And especially if you look at the past image of the High Priestess, we see that, you know, she's standing there with her arms up, you know, bringing down this energy. And if we look, you know, Kabbalistically and all these ideas, it basically connects our conscious mind with the eternal source at the top of the Tree of Life. And so, you know, there's this very sort of lofty notion and very sort of channeling and open flowing kind of an energy to this. And we noticed that she's often shown reading from a book, often the Bible or, you know, other notions are with it. But here the book is closed. Even that is too active for this card. The next card we have is the Empress. And for me, the Empress is predominantly a card about nature and fecundity, about fertility, and, you know, what is it that makes the grass grow and the flowers bloom and the bees go about their business. To me, it is the energy of the Empress card. And so, you know, that notion of that lush life that we often see surrounding that card, and that, you know, the idea of, you know, in the Gaian Tarot, the gardener as being this card, you know, all of these things sort of support this notion. And so what goes before that is, before that life is expanded and growing and in movement, is some form of gestation, some form of waiting, you know, to hatch. And so here we've set the eggs in the nest up in the tree. You know, they are safe and secure, because this card is certainly about nurturing and family and security, and yet they're not ready to hatch. They're just sitting there waiting. When we talk about the Emperor, you know, and the Emperor is one of the cards that people have commented most about the humor of seeing this character hanging out in his boxer shorts. And to me, you know, I posed in a number of places the question of, you know, what is it that gives the Emperor power? Why is he capable of sitting on this throne? And why is he capable of embodying that energy? And, you know, I asked this question of a lot of people, and people have, you know, a whole bunch of different thoughts and ideas. And for me, there are two factors. One is, and maybe they're completely related, but one is his virility, his power, his, you know, natural ability. You know, he's hanging out in the bedroom with the bed all unmade as a symbol of sort of that virility, of that sort of potentially sexual prowess, or, you know, those kinds of things. Who was there with him beforehand? You know, everything's done, that scene's over, but there was something going on here before. And the other is actually sort of secretly encoded on his boxer shorts, and that is his bravery. You know, because in order to lead requires a lot of bravery. In order to take action and rule requires a lot of bravery. And, you know, that idea of his heart as being a prominent and powerful aspect of him, you know, not the scepter, not the crown, you know, those things are secondary. Those things are symbols of his power, but they aren't his actual power. And so that combination of life force and bravery are the things that I see as being the Emperor's strength and power. When we get to the Pope or to the Hierophant, you know, the question for me around the Pope is, how does one become the Pope? Does one choose? Was it ordained before we were born? You know, how does one acquire that level of status, you know? And, you know, to me, there's this idea of awakening, you know, or, you know, we could even think of it as salvation that a lot of people talk about. And, you know, I've had the pleasure of reading for, you know, heaps of people at this point in time. And I read for quite a number of people who were, quote unquote, saved. And it's very interesting to me that in many of those cases, that experience permanently altered their lives. And I, you know, I've known some of these people for going on 10 years, and their lives have been truly transformed. Their lives do not return to what they were before. They actually live completely different after that. And it's a very interesting notion to me. You know, and also the idea of, you know, did the Pope want to become the Pope? Did, you know, at what point did the Pope consider that they might become the Pope? At what point did they become aware that, you know, that they were chosen in that manner? On the one hand, we have the Dalai Lama, who is, you know, searched out and found at a young age and, you know, trained and taught. But on the other hand, we have, you know, all the priests within the Catholic faith who are, to a certain extent, all raised in the same structure, and yet yet eventually one of them becomes this person, right? And so in this card, I sort of chose to try and indicate that moment at which the divine opened up the heavens and shone a light on them and awakened their hearts to what was going on, and that it set them up to understand who they were and what they were and the roles that they were going to serve. And here, you know, I have them walking away from the houses and buildings in the background because they are becoming in some ways an outsider to what's going on. When we get to the Lover's card, you know, the Lover's card is often referred to as a card of choices. You know, we see this image commonly of a man usually standing between two women, and people will say that he's trying to make up his mind which one to be with. You know, and we have Cupid up in the upper corner there, getting ready to shoot his arrow and, you know, strike this person full of love. And, you know, here we have, though, this idea of what happens before we have these choices. What happens while we are waiting for, you know, inspiration or for love to find us, or waiting for the right person, you know? And there's a sort of sad feeling that I often see in people who are waiting to find somebody or waiting for that moment. And they're, you know, they're almost biding their time until something actually happens for them. You know, they're just waiting to meet that right person, and they just kind of, you know, are hanging out and waiting and waiting and waiting. And so I decided to have this person, the character of this card, be alone, hanging out and waiting for what was going on. In the Chariot cards, there's this sort of often motion to what's going on. It's a card about being on the right path, and we often see, you know, the king, the warrior. You know, some say that it's the Archangel Michael. It depends on who you ask and which decks you're looking at. You know, steering this chariot out, pulled by these animals, and everything is moving ahead. And there's this sort of dichotomy in the chariot where some say that it is actually the movement of the Holy Spirit, or, you know, these ideas in action, and that it is this sort of dynamism of the unity of spirits into the duality of the world is represented by these two horses. But in the chariot here, there's nothing going on, or at least nothing that we can understand. The chariot to me is one of those energies that connects us from the unmanifest unity of spirit into the manifest duality or multiplicity of the world. And here we see that spirit is withdrawn. Spirit is in hiding. Or in hiding sounds a little too scared or too whatever, but it is withdrawn and waiting to set itself in motion. You know, the curtains will be pulled back, the horses will be harnessed, and everything will start to move again. When we look at the Justice card, and this is another one that took forever for me to resolve, I really struggle a lot between the symbolism of the Justice card, to some extent the Wheel of Fortune card, and the Hanged Man. And what is the actual difference between those? You know, what is the difference preemptive energy in that? And so, you know, here we have, number one, the Hangman showing in the background, you know. So the Hangman's already existed. Justice has passed a verdict at some point. But this is not them in court. This is not them hanging out. This is them sitting around waiting to be called on to pass judgment. And, you know, I played with writing different things on the text of the book, you know, whether it was a book of law, whether it was, you know, I was going to write Torah on it, or, you know, or tarot, or different things. And what I realized is that one of the things about justice is blind, but justice is also, to some extent, unknowable. That is to say that, in theory, other than being appointed as judges, those judges' personal lives and personal being is irrelevant. It is hidden from us. And although, you know, as tarot readers, we all know that everybody's personal stuff bleeds into every aspect of their lives, There's this sort of unknowable aspect to it. And secondly, when I was drawing the face of the character, I really wanted to make this one equivocal. There was no obvious emotion to it. Were they angry? Were they upset? Were they worried? Was there guilt? Was there pressure? Was there stress? You know, I really wanted them to be open, wide open to interpretation. So most people immediately have said that this character is setting precedent for an upcoming case. Who am I to disagree with that idea as well? When we get to the Hermit card here, we get to this sort of notion of what's the thing that's central to the Hermit? And perhaps because of the name of my store, I think that the lamp is very central to this idea, you know, my store being the Hermit's lamp. But to me, the lamp is actually a symbol of the Hermit's energy in action. That is, although we depict it as a lamp for metaphor's sake, the lamp is actually the light that shines from those people who are connected to spirit and walking their path. So in that sense, the Hermit is a little like a star in the sky. Its internal fusion creates light for us and radiates outwards, and we can see it and appreciate and guide and navigate about it, but its internal life and where that light comes from is a secret. And so in this notion, too, I've got the dove here coming with the fire to spark that candle, to get that light going. It is a spiritual source that is kindling that light and making it move ahead. Oh, what was that sound? Did somebody come in? Okay, well, can somebody let me know that you're all still there or that somebody's still there?
I'm here.
All right, perfect. I heard a weird beeping sound, so I just want to make sure nobody went away.
Teresa's still here.
Great. Okay. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, Cheryl's here. But yeah, that sound might mean that somebody left.
Okay. Well, they'll make their way back if they can, I guess. The next thing that we get to is the Wheel of Fortune card. And here I wanted to sort of, again, this is one that I actually didn't struggle with at all. It came out immediately the first time that I drew it, more or less is what it is, and I just went back and refined some of the artwork. And, you know, to me, the sort of the three characters on this card, the Sphinx, the monkey, or the, you know, the force of communication, and the crocodile or alligator, the force of sort of disruption, you know, here they're actually all working together, which is a reminder of something that we don't often see, or certainly I don't often hear about when it comes to the Wheel of Fortune card, is that those different characters in these different positions all actually work together to make things happen. The Wheel of Fortune turns because of all these things working together. The other thing that's going on in this card is that in the background is the tower. And, you know, this is the tower that we'll see later on, you know, getting ready to be struck and destroyed, you know. And so there's this very strong notion of karma and consequences, you know. What begins here as what looks like maybe a little playful element to make a little Ferris wheel ride for these characters becomes a, you know, has the potential to have all sorts of consequence later on, depending on how everybody handles it. I also very much wanted to include the notion that these three characters are to some extent arguing with each other. You know, I see the monkey as heckling the Sphinx and the alligator, the crocodile. You know, I see the crocodile as trying to bark orders and being controlling, and yet not quite being able to get in there and do anything. And on the other hand, the Sphinx, the symbol of harmony and balance, is actually the one who's doing all the work here. You know, and so it talks about that they're all interconnected and interdependent, but they are not reliant. The power balance is not even, and that is also part of what makes the wheel turn. When we get to the Strength card, I wanted to sort of speak to this notion of the grace and ease. You know, we often see this image of a woman holding the lion, petting the lion, opening its mouth. You know, in some decks, going for a ride on the back of some beast. You know, in the Toth deck and so on. And you know, here is this sort of notion of what was expected before happens. You know, and on the one hand, the character cultivates grace. You know, and I mean that in the sort of Christian or spiritual sense of connection and ease with spirits. You know, they are composed and at ease. There's, you know, they're not expecting anything, but they are also very tranquil. And on the other hand, we've got the sort of the lion in the background hiding in the bushes there, getting ready to pounce. And the sort of notion that when we are composed and when we are in tune and in serenity, even calamity can be handled with ease, with grace, with tranquility in ourselves. When we get to the hangman, we see the chocolate cake. And the image here is this, is, you know, of the noose, the trap hidden with a slice of cake hanging out. And, you know, as a friend of mine put it when he saw this card, he goes, "Man, Andrew, if I was walking through the forest and found some cake, that'd be me. Whee! Up, hanging from the tree." And, you know, the card here, the idea about the hangman that I really wanted to convey was, we see the hangman stuck all the time. He's trapped, you know. He's strung up there. And yet, the hangman is always complicit, to me anyway, in this process of being strung up. There is always this way in which the hangman chose something, not necessarily willingly, but chose something that encouraged them to be in the situation and as often as not to stay in that kind of situation or position. And so we have with the hangman, you know, the idea that they really wanted the cake, and so they get pulled up there. But, you know, if someone comes up and says, "Hey, if you can hang in here for another day, I'll give you another slice of cake," they might say yes. You know, and it also ties to the notion that in some relationships, the thing that people come to dislike about their partner is often closely related, if not the same thing, that they were very, very interested in and found appealing in the beginning. And so there's this dichotomy of what do we want, and do we actually want or know what's good for us? Or is it all just temptation? When we get to death, you know, we'll see that sort of kept with the idea of just putting a number here instead of naming it. You know, and this card really, to me, symbolizes the whole deck, you know. We have the skeletal figure waiting to harvest his person who's growing in a pot, you know. We have the moon card up in the sky, recognizing the idea of cycles and patterns of the movement and order of things. And, you know, even the measurement, you know, he's got this tape measure he's holding up. And everything about this is sort of in some kind of balance and harmony and pattern, you know. And although we as people often experience death as this massively disruptive force that often seemingly comes out of nowhere, you know, I think that people who work more with the earth, people who have, you know, suffered certain kinds of experiences, you know, they come to see the, you know, the transience and the movement and the structure of life and death and that shifting from one side to the other. And so this is part of what I wanted to convey in this card. The Temperance card, being a card that usually speaks of this sort of connection with the higher self and all these kinds of things. Here, that connection, that moment of the rainbow, that pouring of water from one side to another, from one cup to another. Here we have that sort of literally waiting to happen. And this is very much that, you know, "Why have you forsaken me" card. You know, we could almost picture a little character standing on the rooftops down below in the rain, shaking their fist at the heavens and said, you know, "Why have you forsaken me? Why have you left me here? Why is it raining? Why is the sun not there?" You know, and all those feelings that we often experience as frustrations in our lives, and those moments where our beliefs about what we thought Spirit might do for us or give to us are not coming to fruit, or not coming to the fruit in the way that we want. And yet they are often very, very close. And most often I find when people are the most frustrated, it is often very shortly thereafter that that connecting to their higher self or that intervention comes and happens. When it comes to the devil card, we get to the party, and life is people don't choose the devil card. I mean, sometimes out of need, and sometimes out of pain, but most often people choose it out of desire, out of greed, out of lust, and so here we have the devil presenting with a great big party, come on, we got martinis, we got cake, we're stoking up the fire, don't mind these chains that I'm standing on or that pitchfork. No, those are left over from last week's event. They're not for you. It'll be okay. Come on in. And then people start to take actions that that bind them or trap them in one way or another, and the scene, the little sort of secret thing that nobody's commented on anyway so far, is if you look in the fire just beside the pitchfork there, there's actually a little skull in the fire there. There's sort of this notion of choosing a road that we know will lead to suffering, and yet being unable to dissuade ourselves from it. This loss of self-control. When we get to the Tower card here, we move to this place where the karmic motion of the Wheel of Fortune starts to come to bear. And here we have this sort of outward structure where nothing's really going on. We can't see anybody. There's nothing obviously happening. But because we know what's coming next, we know that little Zeus-like guy up on top is going to throw that bolt down and shatter things. So what is going on in there? And that is really the kind of question. The Tower cards, on the one hand, can symbolize external, dynamic, sudden change, Oh my God, you lost your job. Oh, this happens, any number of big drastic changes. But on the other hand, it also symbolizes the breaking of the ego, and the Tower here is also the Tower of Babel, that overreaching and overstepping. And when people have those kinds of problems, they are often completely unseen, firstly by themselves, and secondly by those around them, because they are hidden. Their ego issues, their narcissism, their anxieties, their obsessions, their deceits are concealed within the walls of their tower, within the walls of their persona in the world. And it's only when the lightning strikes that truth can be revealed. And the lightning itself is certainly a symbol of revealing divine truth. When we get to the Star cards, the first thing is that the Star card is actually one of my favorite cards that I drew in this deck. Every time I look at it, and every time I look at the way in which I drew the water flowing out of the garden hose that this person's holding on to, I have to say I'm just so amused by it. The other thing about the Star card is, and the stars themselves, if we think about what are we looking at from the stars? Why do we gaze at them? Why do we create stories and structures around them? Partly we can say it's for navigation, for historically, for trying to understand things. But beyond that, we're actually trying to see beyond what we can see. We're trying to look. If we look at astrology, in the same way that we use tarot, we can look at astrology as trying to open up the machinery of our universe and comprehend and extrapolate and interpret deeper metaphysical realities that we can only infer from study and from the movement of things over time and from experience, but that we can't witness directly. And so on the one hand, we could say, well, the creator set in motion the order of the stars, and there's a pattern and a habit, and all of these things influence us and direct us and shape us. But on the other hand, we can't actually directly reach that creator and ask them what's going on. And so here we have the Star card, which to me represents destiny, fate, you know, the sort of connection with the underlying structure as in astrology, and trying to go from what's beyond it. And to me, the water that is often seen pouring from one cup to another is this sort of movement of spirit and of energy from the creator out into creation. And so here, that flow is symbolized by the garden hose. You know, there's a little pipeline back to the creator, but yet we still don't get to see what's going on and who's doing it. The moon card is probably one of my other favorites in this deck. I spent a long time working with the moon card, drifting back further and further and further and playing with other ideas. You know, the standard image of a pool of water with a crab or a crayfish or a lobster or whatever crawling out of it, and you know, the two dogs or wolves, and then in the distance the towers. It was very hard for me to get beyond that. You know, what was going on before that happened? Given that the moon card often symbolizes long journeys and long things, it's like, man, how far back do we need to go? But then on the other hand, to me, the moon card also symbolizes mystery, the mysterious things, you know. It symbolizes, you know, the feminine reproductive part of the cycle, which, although we know some about it now, you know, continues to be a complex thing for us to understand. And it represents those lunar patterns and cycles and the sort of mysterious and liminal spaces. It represents the dead and ghosts and ancestors and, you know, all these kinds of ideas to me. And so here I wanted to play on sort of the notion of, first of all, the lobster or the crab is often spoken of as being a symbol of the resurrection or of Christ. This is very old symbols for it. You know, and this sort of idea of it emerging out of the waters is sort of coming from one life into another. And then once it goes past those columns in the distance, it's moving into yet another stage of being. But here I wanted this to sort of be the dance between the conscious, the person in the boat, and the unconscious, or maybe the collective conscious, you know, that stuff going on under the water there, and a way in which we can work with that and play with that, and yet in a way in which it can also surprise us. Won't the person in the boat be surprised when they pull up a big crayfish instead of a fish? You know, it's not what they're looking for, and yet maybe it's exactly what they need. They can still gain sustenance from it in one way or another. When we get to the sun card, you know, to me the sun card is about play and activity, and I sort of step back to the notion of rest. And you know, here the sun is out, but everybody's taking a siesta. You know, it's not this sort of active children playing. It's just you know, going for a horseback ride or children playing on the fields or, you know, any of these kinds of things that we often see. It is this more you know, calm and serene energy. This is the sun on a hot day when you've got a hammock and some shade and you just happen to drift off while reading your book. And so it's that idea of rest and the way in which rest is equally as important as activity and play. When we get to the judgment card, you know, the first thing was I was looking for a way to put my hometown in here. So we've got the CN Tower and, you know, they don't call it the Sky Dome anymore. I forget what they call it now, the Rogers Center, I think. But, you know, these sort of Toronto-based landmarks as a city. And then on the other hand of that, instead of, you know, Gabriel coming down and blowing his horn and waking the dead and getting them ready for judgment, we have the record keeping. We have the notion of keeping track of things, keeping score. You know, although the judgment happens at the end, you know, much like Santa, they've kept their list and they've checked it twice. And, you know, there's this sort of idea of record keeping here. And often in people who are very judgmental, we get this notion of them keeping score all the time and that being a difficult aspect for them to change. People who hold on to slights and are hard-pressed to release them will often, you know, sort of keep mental record books and so on. The final card that we have here is the world card. And here we have the, normally we have the very structured and ordered piece, you know. We have this sort of notion of everything's in place, everything's in order, the different animals are distributed around the card, and the woman or the figure dancing in the middle is working and dancing with the universe, both creating and reacting and being in harmony with the ebb and flow of everything. But here we have that ungoverned chaos, you know. The eagle is trying to get the snake is biting the bull is struck the person and sent them up into the air, and the person flying into the air has further startled the eagle. And we have this sort of chaos that actually is more reminiscent of the fool's sort of open-endedness. And yet, on the other hand, we have the witnessing of that chaos by this character in the distance, who is sort of standing in a stern posture and holding their rod or their wand or their staff, about to come out and impose their order on things and bring everything back to bear. You know, it's a little bit of the children, if you guys are going to keep fighting, we'll turn this car around and go home. It's very much that kind of energy, at least as I see it, card. So that was my journey through the major arcana. Does anybody have any questions or thoughts before we slide into working with this tarot spread?
Yeah, I have a question. Could you talk a little bit about the image on the backs of the cards?
Yes. So on the back of the cards, if you were seeing the promotional material that I made for this deck, you know, there's a postcard kicking around and some other stuff like that. We have the Zeus-like lightning bearer from the tower card, and we have the death card guy and death himself hanging out at a bus stop waiting for their bus, you know, the little post with the bus route number is 78 and these kinds of ideas. And, you know, I wanted to sort of talk with, you know, the way in which the sort of life waits to happen, in which things are waiting, in which all of these characters are waiting for their moment to shine. And so on the back of the card here, we have the fool represented by the dog in the front. You know, this is the same dog, and the leash is still attached. We have in the upper left-hand corner the same house, or possibly the same house. I'm open to different interpretations. As seen in the background scenery of the world card. So we have this idea of beginning and end, you know, the full cycle of things. I chose to include the moon as opposed to the sun because for me, the, you know, when the moon's out, the day is ending. So it's sort of the full cycle has happened. And then sort of foreground here is death checking his wristwatch. What time is it? Whose time is it? Is it the dog's time? Is it something else's time? Has death got somewhere to be? You know, does death have time to have a coffee? You know, and sort of this idea of death checking their watch is one that, you know, in the postcard I drew as well, we see death looking as if they're checking their wristwatch to see what time the bus is coming. So on the back of the card, I wanted to include this notion of everything is utterly static in some ways. There's no movement. There's no real, you know, I mean, there's some visual movement because of the use of angles and, you know, the line work. But there's actually nothing moving. Everything is utterly still, and everything is truly just waiting to begin, you know, whether it's when it turns to 3 o'clock or when, you know, whatever time it is that it starts. This, the back represents the sort of idea of everything waiting to sort of begin and end and dance this cycle all over again. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you. I totally misread the back of the card. I didn't. So, yeah, this explains a lot. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Cool. Well, I would, whether you care to share it here or whether you'd like to email it to me, I'd love to hear what you thought about it as well, because I'm very curious about the ways in which the artwork, now that I released it into the world, has been received and what people are getting from it. So,
Oh, well, but I didn't see, I didn't realize that that was the skeleton's arm. I ended up turning the card, and it looked almost like someone wearing a skirt with their legs and holding the card between their feet. And I thought, no, that can't be right.
I can see that, though. I can see that could be pretty funny, too. Yeah, definitely. Excellent. Does anybody else have any questions? All right. Well, in that case, I would like to talk about this tarot spread that I have created here. And so, you know, the first page, we can basically just kind of skip over it while we're doing here. If you're listening to this recording, we've covered a lot of it in the conversation already, and you will have read it. So we don't really need to go through it in that way. Basically, what we're going to do is if you're not using my deck, which is of course totally cool, you can just pull the major cards out of what you're doing. And you know, the one thing I guess I will address is when it comes to working with a majors only deck, or when it comes to working with just the majors, essentially from my point of view, the majors cards are about the really big, important energies in our lives. You know, they're not, should I stop at McDonald's or should I stop at Tim Hortons? Okay. They're not about, should I get winter tires or not? They're not about, what happens if I try and write off this extra piece on my taxes? They're not about sort of details that, while they have repercussions, are not likely to change the whole course of your life. To me, the tarot, the major cards, are those forces which come in and they completely change our lives in one way or another. Either we gain a big amount of status, something is powerfully transformed, you know, we meet the person of our dreams, we lose the person of our dreams, we win the war, or we are, you know, our tower is shattered and we have to completely build our life again. You know, they're about these big, profound energies. And they also really delve very deeply into our sense of who we are and what we are. You know, all you need to do is listen to people talking about, any of the systems of determining what your birth cards are. And they'll be like, oh, I'm this and this and that, and this. And people identify very powerfully with those ideas because these cards define both the best kinds of qualities and, and also the problems of being human. And so, you know, whereas the numbered cards are more of the how and the details, and the court cards are more the people, these are these big archetypal energies, you know, and everybody has their little story and their archetype that they feel they are, you know. Are they the superhero? You know, are they the dad, the mom? Are they the ruler, the leader, all these kinds of ideas. And, you know, we all interplay with these kinds of energies and notions from our culture and our brain and so on. So when we're working with a majors only deck, working with those levels of understanding, which can certainly allow us to go deeper. Okay. So the spread itself is relatively simple. Okay. There are five cards. They start in the center. And essentially the center is like the center of the clock. And then the second card is at 3 o'clock. The third card is at 6 at the bottom. The fourth card is at 9. And the final card, the fifth card, is at the top, right? And just like on the face of a clock. And the cards themselves represent the first card. Represents the person's motivation, you know. And if we're looking at the little graphic I drew for it, I've got the fool's dog here, you know. What actually got them started? What actually is motivating people? What is motivating you? And the second card, you know, we've got the magician peeking out from around the corner here. And, you know, it's about what are the aspirations? What are they hoping for? At this point, they've, you know, they're trying to make something better of themselves. And what is it that they are hoping to get out of that that this process, you know? And when we get to the third card, we're getting down to how's that going to go, what is there for them? What is working for them? You know, what is helping them, or, you know, move along this, and whether this is in themselves or in other people. And when we get to the fourth card, this is a card of what the person really needs to do. What is going to be the effort here? What is the hard part of this? And then finally, we get to the fifth card, you know, the little gates with the key and the lock. And, you know, what are they going to arrive to when they open that door and, you know, move into whatever's on the other side of it? What is that going to be for them in their lives, and how are they going to feel about it, and all of these kinds of ideas? And when we're working with this spread, you know, there's a few kind of caveats to look at up front. The first is, the spread is not helpful for yes or no questions. You know, often people will ask a question, and really what they mean is, am I going to get a job? Is it going to be okay? Will this person come back? And, you know, those cards, those kinds of questions are much better answered by a yes-no approach. And, you know, if you don't have something that you're doing like that, please go on my website and download my free ebook off the front, and you'll see yes-no interpretations for every single card, and you can just work with that. It's very easy. This spread also doesn't really do that well for interpreting and exploring many, many paths. And so the kinds of things that it's really good for is when we know we are committed to something and we want to walk this road and see how we're going to be able to handle it and what our challenges are going to be, this is something that's great for that. You know, if somebody is going to say, you know I want to be a doctor and I'm going to go to school for this, this is a great spread to break out for that, because it's assuming that you're going to see yourself through to the end, but it's going to talk about how you get there with the most grace and ease, and how you deal most with your own ego and strengths and limitations as you go through that process. You know, as I'm wrapping up with this call, really wrapping up my process with this tarot deck, in the next week or two, probably after I get back from teaching in Dallas, I'm going to start the process for my next deck. And one of the things that I'm going to do is sit down and do this spread for myself in order to help myself understand the process that I'm engaging in, so that I can best move through that process. And so, you know, if someone's thinking they're going to change their careers, if someone's committed to leaving a relationship, if people are committed to moving to another country, you know, this is a great spread for those kinds of things, where the goal and the outcome is certainly known or suspected, but really what's more important is understanding how to live that. And so at this point, I want to talk about doing a spread for somebody. If somebody in the room has a question that would kind of relate to what we're talking about, that they don't mind their question living on the recording. So does anybody have any questions?
Yeah, I have a question.
Okay. Can you say your name? Because I'm not sure who I'm talking to.
Oh, I'm Cheryl Smith.
Yes, Cheryl.
And I'm committed to creating a workbook on how to read with the Tarot de Marseille. So
okay.
I'm just analyzing that. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. So I'm going to shuffle here for you and deal them out so that I can look at them, if that's cool with you.
Sure.
As I say in the approach, I would encourage everybody to start this spread with whatever it is that they like to do, and I generally do a lot of shuffling for people. So. All right. So, we're gonna. I would ask everybody to kind of flip to. The third page here, I've created a little workbook, which I've included supplementary questions to get people to help people with the process of reading and interpreting the cards. You know, and so the idea is, you know, the center card, which we're going to flip over here, represents motivation. And then there's a series of four questions. You know, how do we get, you know, the first one is, how do we get from this scene to what we are used to seeing in the card. And, you know, the idea is that you'll look at it, you'll think, and you'll say something, and then you will either it will be a short phrase, or you'll make it into a short phrase where you'll start off with what's written right underneath is, to get what I want, I think I need to, you know, whatever your little phrase is about how you think the transition from the card that we're looking at here to the more traditional card. So the card that we see in the middle here for you, okay, is the Justice card. Okay. And so the first thing that we're looking at here is what are the motivations, right? What is it that you're looking to accomplish, or why are you getting into this project, right? And right. You're writing a book about the symbolism of the Marseille deck, is that right?
It's not the symbolism. It's actually a practical, you know, how do I use the cards to do a reading?
Okay, yeah.
And I guess, I'll have to talk about the symbolism of the cards, too. Yeah, but...
Yeah, you'll see something about it anyway. But So when you're writing this book, right? Why are you writing this book? Why are you writing this book?
I guess because I want to share, you know, my years of knowledge with other people, and I would like people to buy the book. It would boost my income.
Well, that's always nice too, right?
Yeah.
Right. And when we look at the character here, right? You know, because we're using the deck that I created. You know, here this person is studying, right?
Uh-huh.
And in the background, there's also this person who's stuck, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that we see in this symbolism the idea of you wanting to help people to move through stuff, because I don't know what you hear about working with the Marseille deck, but one of the things that I hear a lot is, I don't know how you read that deck because there's nothing to look at and nothing to talk about, you know?
Yeah, that's what I want
to answer.
Especially
when we're looking at the number cards. Exactly,
mm-hmm.
right? And so on the one hand, people are very stuck, and on the other hand, you're going to give them a system or an approach which will help them be unstuck or avoid getting stuck, right?
Right.
And so let me ask you this question, though, to kind of continue with the handed. How do you think that what do you think is the transition from the Justice card as we see it here to the Justice card that we are more accustomed to seeing?
Well, actually, the figure would have to put down the book, get up, actually take hold of those scales, and would have to find a sword somewhere to hold up also.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I could see, relating to myself, that, yeah, I need to maybe put down the book, stop my constant research and preparation, and somehow seize my tools and get on with it.
Yeah. Yeah, so we can say, well, we answer the first question here. To get what you want, you think you need to get your tools moving and start working on it.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Okay. When we... and so what else does that tell you about your motivations? You know, what does that sort of transitional energy tell you about your motivation right now?
Well, it tells me that I do want to transition from doing a lot of studying and research into a more practical approach, actually using the deck rather than studying it historically.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, it suggests to me that you're motivated by coming to, I'm going to say, an end to your time of study, even though, of course, we all know that tarot is an infinite and endless point of study. Right.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And what positive qualities do you see in the Justice card here?
Actually, to me, it does look like the face almost is starting to turn away from the book and look towards the scales and say, maybe if I get my nose out of that book, there's more going on here, more that I could be doing.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Something interesting over on that table. Yeah.
Yeah. So when we look at the positive qualities, you see that they are they have a growing awareness of what needs to be done to move ahead, right? And
right.
So we could say for your sentence, I need to make sure that I keep aware of the work at hand.
Right.
Would that sound good? And
yes,
then what are the qualities that maybe you don't like or don't seem so helpful about this card?
Well, I do need to avoid just vegetating on that chair with a book and that would make me become the hangman, just stuck in research reading mode all the time.
Mm-hmm. So, so you could say that you need to avoid, I don't know, would procrastination be a good word? Or would you say endless study?
Yeah, they're actually one and the same. You can procrastinate by just perpetually researching. Yeah.
It's true. It's just like writers can procrastinate by buying pens and notebooks, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So we're going to move to the second card here. And if anybody has any questions about how this is working, then please unmute yourself and jump right in, okay? So the next card we have here, which represents your hopes and aspirations, okay? And we have the Hangman.
Oh wow.
Mm-hmm. So, so the first thing that I would say to you is, what do you think the best thing is about this card?
Oh, well, the big piece of cake is the best thing.
Uh-huh. So there's definitely a notion that the goal, the outcome of, having the book in your hands and in stores and, flying about the world and so on, right? The actual outcome part is a very you're very focused on that kind of outcome part, right? What do you feel when you look at this card?
I feel the temptation, to just go for the cake. And then realizing that's a trap. I think relating this to my hopes and aspirations about my book. Mm-hmm. So,
But you know what? You don't need to worry about that too much. I'll help you make that connection. So I want you to just focus on, what do you feel when you look at this card? What emotions does it bring up for you?
I just think, boy, I would really love to have a big piece of cake like that, but I know it's bad for me.
Okay. So, when you're thinking about this, right? So we're going to say, I am thinking getting what I want will help me find joy. We'll just adjust a little bit, right? But also because it's the Hangman, and although this varies a little bit from the script that we have written, we also need to be mindful that you're also a little worried that something about this process might not be what you hoped, right? You might get there and it might not be quite what you're expecting it to be. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound fair?
Yeah, it does.
So, I wrote this script and the structure here to help people working independently. But, we also need to be flexible about these things too, because in readings, information comes up. And it doesn't matter whether we're expecting it to happen there or we expected it to happen somewhere else. If it is important to the conversation, it needs to be talked about. So, yeah. So the next card we have here, okay, which represents the things you have going for you, okay, is the World card.
Yeah.
And so the question I have for you about this card is, who or what does this card remind you of in your life?
It's funny with that. It looks like a cow in the front. Oh, and the people flying. It reminds me of the art of Marc Chagall.
Okay.
And of course, that is very colorful and playful and fanciful. So it does remind me of also I'm wanting one of my dreams is to do some workshops where we just do a lot of fun, playful, creative things with tarot.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So which brings us to our next. And when we're looking at this, right, the statement I wrote here is I can get assistance from, right? And uh-huh. What we're going to do is take what you said because, hanging out with Chagall isn't going to happen. the answer, though, is you can get assistance from your fun and your playfulness. And uh-huh. You also mentioned being fun and playful with other people, that I think that you can look for assistance from other people in around being fun and playful and bringing that into your work. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
What capabilities do you see in this card?
Capabilities. Mm-hmm. I see. Well, that little person in the back there, I think the capability of being fun and creative, but it never descends into complete chaos. There's always an underlying purpose and something to get out of it. It's not just chaos. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense. Your statement reminds me of contact dance where people are dancing and they're basically reacting and relating to their partner, but there's no structure or movement, and everybody sort of tries to stay in that place where everyone's in balance and everyone is influencing and being influenced at the same time. So we can say that you are skilled at walking the line between creativity and chaos?
Yeah, that's a good statement.
Okay. And then we get, so how do you think what you see in the card can help you?
I think it could probably, this card can just remind me to keep things light and playful because I can tend, especially in my writing, I tend to get really heavy and academic. Mm-hmm. And so this can just be kind of an antidote to that.
Excellent. So your skills and your allies will help you, be light and playful and not descend into academia.
Right. Uh-huh.
Okay. So that's the third card done. The fourth card represents the effort that you need to put into this. And we have the Devil card.
Okay.
So the first question is, what kind of effort do you see in this card?
It almost makes me seem like he's trying too hard to have fun.
Uh-huh.
A sense of it being forced.
Uh-huh. Fair enough. So the statement that I have under here is I might have to work harder to make sure, and given what you said, I would add on to that I am truly having fun.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me, contrasting it to the World card. The World card to me is just pure joy in that. And this one,
yep.
He's supposed to be having pleasure, but it doesn't give me that feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Devil card is to me is often this energy of I ate the cake, the cake wasn't that good, and now I feel crappy. It's like, man, I really want a donut, but actually donuts, the first bite is good and everything else just doesn't taste good. And then mm-hmm. and then I eat a bunch of sugar and I go on a ride,
Yeah.
So, or we could even rephrase it maybe to say, I think I might have to work hard to make sure that I have genuine fun or, something along those lines. You could qualify the fun a little bit more. What is the actions, or what about this card is not so exciting to you?
What's not so? Well, I don't like that pitchfork.
Mm-hmm. What about it?
Actually, pitchfork, I think of those cartoons where the devil's like prodding somebody in the butt, like you're being goaded, and I could see that in myself, goading yourself to do jobs that you really don't want to do because you think you should or you think it's going to be good for you to do it.
So if we read the sentence that I wrote here then, I might have to remind myself of why I am doing this when I am goading myself to do the work.
Right, yeah, when I'm goading myself to do something I'm not really enjoying, remind myself that joy of the world card is what I really want to go for.
For sure. And also that, to me, the word goading, largely implies stuff that we weren't choosing to do, right? So I sense in this sort of delicate balance of the, in the beginning we talked about you need to, you need to step into that action, you need to step into those tools, and you need to, not get caught up in studying and learning and whatever, but that you might also find some inspiration and some play from that, and that you might also need to, look for those play, and when you feel stuck and you feel a certain kind of tension that, is often indicated in this card, that the answer might not be disciplined, but instead to be playful, and then to allow the work to flow again from that.
Oh, yeah, that's right, exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, and so the final card that we have here is the Temperance card. And so the question for you with this card is, if you arrived at your goal and found this scene, how would you feel about it?
Actually, I would feel really great because I live in a semi-desert and we've been having a drought and I can't remember when I saw rain last. People
uh-huh.
don't even go out and dance in the streets when it rains. So this would be pure heaven.
Wonderful. So the statement that goes with this is, if successful, I will feel, and wonderful, like dancing in the street in the rain,
right.
Hydrated, like the drought is over, we could take our pick, right?
That's right.
But it sounds to me that, that there is a real nourishment and sustenance for you at the end of this.
Yeah, I think there would be. Yeah, the sense of accomplishment, and if people bought my book, actual sustenance. I think
for
the sense
sure.
of accomplishment. I love that little figure up there. That's like the Sphinx, I guess. Was that the same Sphinx as on the Wheel of Fortune?
I think of it as the angel that's often seen on the Temperance card, but it could be the Sphinx as well. Well, that Sphinx is tricky. It could be everywhere, right?
Oh, yeah, now that I compare them, they're not quite the same. But, yeah, that angel, to me, the angel, and actually the angel up there, is on the same side of the clouds as the sun. To me, yeah, that is just really a promise of just
mm-hmm.
everything falling into place and being wonderful.
Yeah, excellent. So that is the spread. That is the approach, right? And, we go through and we look for, What are the expectations? What are the the ideas and feelings? And obviously, if we had more time, or if we needed more time, we could, conversationally go much deeper, right? We could use our mm-hmm. questions and our ideas to continue to delve into and to deepen this process that we are working on with people. But but that's the idea behind the spread there. So you notice that although the end is somewhat predictive, overall we're really avoiding looking for predictive answers, right? We're not trying to tell people exactly what that road's going to be like, or be like, oh, you're going to meet this and that's going to happen. We're really looking to just kind of help people understand themselves and help them understand what they're doing and how they're going to be able to kind of get themselves to that place in the best way possible. Because I know for me, my approach to writing is one of discipline and structure. And the notion of fun being something that would actually feed more into that is not quite what I would assume first off. So, yeah.
Well, I think this is this technique is brilliant. Just encouraging somebody to free associate on the card, not trying to answer the question or interpret the card, but just free associate, and then just taking that and folding it back into an interpretation. It does kind of open the cards up a lot to to a deeper interpretation. So I love this technique.
Excellent. Great. So we've reached about the end of the structured portion of what I had intended to cover in tonight's class. And what I'm planning to do is sort of the last 20 minutes or so of time that we have left is basically to answer questions, you know, whatever questions that anybody here might have, about the deck, about creating a deck, about the technique that we just went through, about cards in general, and let's just sort of see what people have on their minds. So does anybody have any questions or statements or things that they'd like to bring up to talk about?
Andrew, it's Teresa. I have a question. The Force card, what is that card normally in the another tarot deck?
That card is the Strength card.
The Strength card. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So,
go
ahead.
No. I was just going to say, because as I pictured in the Rider-Waite, the woman with the lion and bending down beside the water, I kept thinking, oh, what is that card? And I couldn't think of it. So it's the Strength card.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Strength card, for sure.
Okay. All right.
Anybody else have questions?
Question.
I mean, people don't have to have questions. If nobody has any questions, we can certainly wrap it up and leave it there as well. I'm not here to force people to ask things.
No, I don't have any questions.
Okay. All right. Well, if nobody else has any questions, then I guess I will say let's leave it there, and we'll call it tonight.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so glad that you ran through the cards and explained, thinking behind them. I think that was so important to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been getting a lot of people asking me where the Little White Book is, as I think I already mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some other stuff that I'm doing, so I don't really have the time to sit down and commit to writing a whole bunch of stuff right now on that. But what I am going to do is starting maybe this week, but definitely next week, about once a week or so, I'm going to write a quick blog piece on the cards and sort of just to speak about some of the thoughts, so much of which I've covered tonight, but, stuff, we'll get into some other stuff that I didn't talk about. And that way, over the next couple of months, I can sort of put it something on every card, and that way people can have further ideas as well. Probably some more questions that I think people would benefit from asking themselves about them, as well as, some of the ideas and symbolism that I sort of see incorporated into the cards. But I also really enjoy hearing what people are seeing and thinking in the cards, because, the reality is that when we create art and it reaches other people and that feedback happens, it really kind of opens up my eyes to deeper levels of what's going on, whether I was consciously building it there or whether it's just kind of coming out of the symbolism. So, you know, as you're playing with the cards and stuff, please, you know, please send me an email. Please let me know what you think or feel. I really enjoy hearing that kind of stuff.
Okay, that sounds good. So when you do the cards on your page, on your Facebook page, you'll be doing each individual card. Is that just going to be random, or are you going to do it in order?
I'll probably do it in order. I will post it to Facebook, but it'll be blog entries on my website. So if you if you subscribe to my blog, if you go to thehermitslamp.com and hit blog, it'll take you to my blog page, and there's instructions to subscribe. You can get them sent to you in your email, or if you use an RSS newsfeed, you can also get them that way. You know, so if you're interested in making sure that you see them, that'll be the best way, because I don't know about everybody else, but I have so much traffic on my Facebook site that I often miss.
So I just wanted to thank you for listening to this recording. And if you are interested in ordering my deck, it is, of course, a majors only deck. The cost is $35, and it is a limited run of 200, and I will not be running any future editions. So once they're gone, they're gone. You can find it, as previously mentioned at the beginning, at thehermitslamp.com/TWTH for tarot waiting to happen. And you can order it right there. There's separate shipping depending on where in the world that you are living. I hope you enjoyed it. And please do let me know about your experiences with the spread and with my deck. I really thrive on that kind of feedback.